Architecture begins to matter, writes Paul Goldberger, when it goes beyond protecting us from the element, when it begins to say something about the world, when it begins to take on the qualifications of art. The question for us is, which buildings make the cut, and why do such a wide majority of the buildings we experience every day seem to fall so short? Paul Goldberger has been looking into such questions since at least 1972, when he was first hired by the New York Times. He was awarded the Pulitzer Prize for his architectural criticism in 1984. And since 1997, he's been the architecture critic for The New Yorker. He's published two books recently, Why Architecture Matters from Yale University Press, and Building Up and Tearing Down, Reflections on the Age of Architecture, which is published by the Monticelli Press. And I'm very pleased to welcome Paul Goldberger back to our show.
Thank you, Leonard. Good to be here.
You put the Chrysler Building on the cover of Why Architecture Matters. What is so significant about that building? Why do so many people, New Yorkers especially, say that it's their favorite building?
It's funny, actually. I feel it's, if not my very favorite, pretty close to it. It's iconic. It's memorable. It's exhilarating. It's elegant. It's different from other buildings, and it has a kind of zest to it. It seems to perfectly embody the jazz age, that period in the 30s that is so emblematic of not just New York, but of what the best of New York in a lot of people's minds.
Well, I like the Empire State Building.
I like that, too.
And yes, you can go to the top. Do you think that the fact that you can't go up to the observation deck at the Chrysler Building anymore adds to its mystique?
That's an interesting thought. Maybe it does. I've never thought of it
that way. It's less democratic.
You may be right. Well, not so much just that there's a kind of the allure of the forbidden there or something. Yes, that's true.
Well, it's not only a space for offices, but also a landmark, a symbol of the city. Do you think people consider it art? And should they?
I think they should consider it art. I think architecture is always art, but it's not only art. The magic of architecture is the way it's balanced kind of tantalizingly in between, in two worlds. It's art and it's not art at the same time.
Well, you write about the negotiation between art and practicality, mm-hmm. which the Chrysler Building
sure.
Achieves. But there are some other buildings considered great where there may be some problems. For example, some of the most famous and celebrated pieces of modern architecture in this country, like Frank Lloyd Wright's Robie House, mm-hmm. Mies van der Rohe's Farnsworth House, they haven't been very successful as places that people wanted to live in.
It's true, but on the other hand, we don't have to live in them. It's somebody else's problem in a way.
But weren't they designed for people to live
in? They were designed for people to live in, but they were not designed as models or prototypes. In other words, you know, the Farnsworth House by Mies van der Rohe, which is, I think, one of the most beautiful houses ever made in history, not just in modern times, is not a model that Mies van der Rohe imagined there'd be thousands and thousands of across the landscape. It's a unique object, and in the end, it succeeds best as almost a pure, almost like a little religious space, like a tiny chapel. It's not terribly livable. But that was Edith Farnsworth's problem, not yours or mine.
Still, I wonder, because both of those buildings were commissioned,
mm-hmm.
And an architect, at least in theory, is doing the
yes.
building for the client, because
mm-hmm.
that's part of the consideration.
Right.
So in the end, isn't Mies van der Rohe or Frank Lloyd Wright, aren't they really being selfish in a way? They're making a work of art and saying, well, I'm a genius, you live with it.
To some extent, they are saying that, of course. Hopefully, if in best circumstances, the relationship between art and function in architecture is not a zero-sum game. You usually do not have to take away from one to get the other. Ideally, you have plenty of both. But remember, in a situation where a private house is commissioned by an individual client, the client has to have some responsibility, because the client could always look at the plans and say, no, this is not what I wanted. You have not given me what I envisioned. Go back, try again, or perhaps I need another architect, one or the other.
Of course, I've looked at both of those buildings and any number of others that were considered unlivable and thought, gee, I'd be happy to live here.
Right, right, exactly.
And maybe it's also because some of us would like to live in the middle of a great work of art, and others, like in the case of the Farnsworth, want to have Venetian blinds.
Right. Well, you know, there's a tendency to assume, of course, that great architecture solves all problems, and it doesn't really. There's a wonderful line. I'm now going to plug another author who I actually like and admire, Alain de Botton, who wrote a book called The Architecture of Happiness, in which he said, I quote this in my book, says, you know, that there are certain kind, he said it more eloquently than I'm about to say it, but something like, you know, there are certain kinds of feelings that even the greatest architecture in the world cannot do as much for you as an aspirin might. So, I mean, sometimes, you know, real life intervenes and an aspirin is better than a great building.
Paul Goldberger has two books that have just been published, Why Architecture Matters from Yale University Press and Building Up and Tearing Down, Reflections on the Age of Architecture from Monticelli Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. And Why Architecture Matters addresses that Alain de Botton thought. You say that it's that, sure, we're interested in the great works of art, but we also experience ordinary architecture.
Very much so.
Our
Absolutely.
Childhood home, the supermarket that we go to. Do these kinds of experiences influence in the same way that architectural masterpieces do?
I think they influence us in different ways, but maybe even more profoundly. You know, I talk in this book about architecture and memory, and about how each of us has our own very, very deep and rich memories of architecture. They may not be great ones, but sometimes they are. And in any event, you know, my childhood room, the neighborhood I lived in when I was 4 or 5 years old, all of those things played a role in shaping me and my sense of places. And everyone has that kind of memory, I think, too. And then, of course, there are the broader memories we all share in our culture of not just masterpieces, but also where architecture gets into other things like the movies and books and art and so forth.
Well, there's also the city experience as opposed to the suburban and the country experience. In New York, if you say pre-war building, that means something very positive, even if the building isn't the most beautiful building.
Right, absolutely, absolutely. Well, that's because there's been a tendency of standards in apartment buildings to have gone down with each generation. So pre-war means, you know, at least you're 50, 60 years old and the standards were higher.
The walls will be thick.
The walls will be thick.
The ceilings will be high.
You got it.
They'll
be
molding.
You got it. Exactly.
And
exactly.
And the windows will be big enough so that you actually get some sunlight.
Yep. Yep. Absolutely.
Was there a building that made you say, I'm going to devote my life to thinking about architecture?
There were several buildings, actually, that did that. I'd been interested in architecture since I was a little kid, but I didn't expect to devote my life to it. And when I went to college, first, all of the Yale campus had a profound effect on me, actually.
But that was also, some of it was designed by a great architect, Paul Rudolph, and some
yes,
others.
Yes, but I went to Yale thinking that those modern buildings by Paul Rudolph and Eero Saarinen and other architects would be the most exciting thing for me. And in fact, then I had a very odd other experience, which was that there was all that Gothic architecture that was kind of fake and romantic and I thought was sort of silly. And the more I lived with it, the more I liked it. And so I had to sort of come to terms with how come all this fake stuff that you're not supposed to like is actually pretty good? What is it about it that makes it work? And that made me really think hard about what makes buildings work for people. Why do some buildings give us one feeling, other buildings give us another? You know, my whole attitude has always been one of looking at architecture as experiential. How does it feel to be there? And in fact, in the other book, in Building Up and Tearing Down, which is an anthology of criticism mostly from the New Yorker, most of the buildings that I review that from that stance, not in terms of where do they fit in some academic theory, but how do they feel to be in.
Although different people react to those details differently. I had an architecture teacher at Brooklyn College who asked us what was wrong with all of those faux Georgian buildings. Mm-hmm. And none of us knew, other than they weren't gorgeous. Right. But it turned out that the fake chimneys were over windows. So that
right.
would have been impossible. But
right,
they were
right,
there
right.
as decorative elements rather than the architect didn't think, well, gee, if I just put them along the blank part of the wall, it'll look real.
Right, right, exactly, exactly. It's amazing the lengths to which fakery sometimes does not go.
Do you think most people are aware of the influence of architecture in their lives? Or is this an unconscious experience?
I think it's both a conscious and an unconscious experience. And in Why Architecture Matters, I was sort of trying to get kind of under the skin of that and figure out how the unconscious experience works, but also celebrate the conscious experience of it and have people be more aware of both sides of it.
Well, one example might be the World Trade Towers, because most people dislike those buildings.
Right.
And over time, they kind of became a symbol, and they accepted them.
Yes.
And, of course, after they were destroyed, they became our first architectural martyrs.
That's exactly right. That's the very phrase I used.
And
I think
quoted
it's
you.
True. And I remember it. I think it's true. I mean, one of the...
Did you ever feel good about those buildings until they were destroyed?
Good is maybe an exaggeration. I definitely came to accept them. And there were a couple of reasons. First, you're absolutely right. I didn't like them at the beginning either. I resented them very much. And the Empire State Building always seemed to me to be a much more deserving holder of the crown of tallest building in New York. But there are a couple of reasons I moved over slightly. One of them is that, you know, it's just too hard to hate a building all the time. It takes too much effort. I mean, buildings are always there. You see them all the time. It's not like a piece of music that if you don't like it, you can turn it off. You don't listen, or a book you don't like, you don't have to read it. You always got to see a building. So I think we condition ourselves to be slightly numb over time to certain buildings because it's just too painful to hate them actively every moment. The other thing about the Trade Center towers, though, is that they did have a kind of abstract beauty, particularly in certain kinds of light, the late afternoon setting sun, the early morning sun, that metal surface reflected the sun in a rather beautiful way sometimes. And they served as a kind of campanile, as a bell tower for lower Manhattan. You know, you come out of the subway and look up and you saw the Trade Center towers, you kind of knew where you were. So all of that made them a little more bearable. But then, of course, you know, the tragedy of 9/11 came, and they became architectural martyrs and transcended other categories entirely.
And many people wanted them to just be rebuilt.
Yes, I'm very glad we didn't do that. I think to have spent billions of dollars to repeat what was still, at bottom, an architectural mistake would have been a terrible mistake.
I remember when they were built, and it reminds me of the title of your other book, building up and tearing down, because many people were upset about the destruction of a neighborhood.
Well, that's right. Radio Row, the old electronics neighborhood. But of course, today, there would be, I think, far more anger and outrage about the destruction of an old neighborhood for buildings like that. You know, the protest was relatively minor by contemporary standards, and it was clear that it was not going to be much more than a pro forma protest. But over the years, the Landmarks Commission was established, grew much stronger, and today I think something like that would not happen.
Well, Lewis Mumford, who was one of your predecessors at the New York Times.
At the New Yorker, rather.
At the New Yorker. You quote him in your book, "The great function of the city is to permit, indeed to encourage and incite, the greatest possible number of meetings, encounters, challenges between all people, classes, groups, providing a stage upon which the drama of life may be enacted." And I wonder whether city planners think in that way ever. For example, the city is still behind the Atlantic Yards project, isn't it? And the Municipal Art Society said that it would be a total disaster because it would cut people and neighborhoods off from each other.
Yeah. Well, I think city planners do think in terms of streets and neighborhoods perhaps more than they did in the 60s when the World Trade Center was designed. But we have begun in the last few years to almost come full circle and again fall into the spell or into the thrall of gargantuan mega projects, which generally are, in fact, destructive of that very street life that Lewis Mumford was talking about and that I think you and I both agree is essential to the city.
This Battery Park City, which is right next to the World Trade Center, mm-hmm. and many people felt that that was kind of a fortress of the sort that we see in other cities, but we are not used to in New York City.
I think Battery Park City, actually, while there it can be faulted on many levels, was designed as a response to the World Trade Center. I mean, remember, it has traditional streets.
Yeah, but
it
you can't get Esplanade. You can't get over to it you can't unless get you over cross one of the West
right.
Side Highway.
You can't get over to it because of the West Side Highway, but that's the West Side Highway was stuck. You were stuck with that. That was a given at the beginning. But once you get there, in fact, you have something that comes closer to resembling a traditional neighborhood than, say, the World Trade Center certainly did. I think Atlantic Yards was and is a mistake, and it's one of the reasons, I suppose. You know, every silver lining has a cloud, every cloud has a silver lining, and the silver lining of the recession is that that is certainly not going to happen immediately and may give us some time to rethink some of the mistakes.
Paul Goldberger is my guest. He has two books out, Why Architecture Matters, from Yale University Press, and Building Up and Tearing Down, Reflections on the Age of Architecture, from Monticelli Press. And we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Paul Goldberger, who is the architecture critic for The New Yorker. And he has two books out, Why Architecture Matters, from Yale University Press, and Building Up and Tearing Down, Reflections on the Age of Architecture, from Monticelli Press. You say our experience of buildings goes hand in hand with how we appreciate cities and argue that streets have a greater influence on an urban environment than the buildings themselves.
This may be an odd thing for an architecture critic to say, but in fact, over the years, I've realized I think streets are more important than buildings, that you can have a wonderful city with a lot of okay but not great buildings if they're put together well. You can't make a wonderful city out of even a few masterpieces. You need background buildings as well as foreground buildings. And
so Chicago works well because it has both.
Chicago has both, absolutely. Absolutely, it has both, yes.
New York, I wonder about. We do have some great buildings. But New York was built for pedestrians, and then people like Robert Moses built roadways and bridges that favored the automobile, mm-hmm. which is what most of the newer American cities are all about. Weren't
newer
they
American
built around
c- newer
the car?
American cities are built almost entirely around the automobile, yes.
So
yes.
Can architecture be appreciated from a car?
Architecture can be appreciated from a car, but a city can't. The urban experience, I think, has to be had on foot. Pedestrianism is key to really a city working. You can see some kinds of architecture from a car. In fact, architecture in Las Vegas is made to be seen from a car. A lot of Houston and Dallas and places like that are made to be seen from a car and, in fact, become less good close up than they might be from afar.
Los Angeles, which is a little bit of both.
Los Angeles is a little bit of both. Los Angeles is a very complicated urban fabric, I think. I feel it's actually more like New York than people acknowledge most of the time. I mean, certainly the climate is different, and certainly it's physically different, but it's... There's something about it culturally and conceptually that's more like New York. It's a big, complicated place that has a fascinating ability to create culture, not just consume it. In fact, really, American culture, such as it is made in New York and Los Angeles.
A listener calls in and says that we shouldn't call the World Trade Center our first architectural martyr because Penn Station was. Now, Penn Station... Mm-hmm. You can yes. address that in just a moment, but I was thinking about Penn Station. That's one that fits in with the title of the other book because mm-hmm. we tore down a masterpiece and
yes,
built
did.
A really horrible building, and that happens all too often. And you wonder, has that stopped in recent years because of Penn Station?
We're doing less of that than we used to. Penn Station truly was an architectural martyr. Once said, you know, it's the building that died that others might live. It is sort of because it led directly to the establishment of the New York City Landmarks Preservation Commission. There'd been talk about that before for many years, but it really hadn't gotten traction until Penn Station, and then people said, oh my goodness, we can never let this happen again. It has, of course, happened again, but the presence of the Landmarks Commission means it happens much less, and we've saved a lot, not just individual buildings, but we've created historic districts where the ordinary buildings, the background buildings, as well as the foreground buildings get saved, and that's absolutely critical. I think, to respond to that listener, I think my original phrase about the Twin Towers was calling them our first skyscraper martyrs. Mm-hmm. So the Penn Station, of course, was not a skyscraper.
A friend, when they were talking about knocking down the Lever House, said, you know, this is ironic because when she first came to New York, she was really upset that they were knocking down these beautiful buildings to build a modern building on Park Avenue,
right,
which turned out to be the Lever House. She was among the picketers protesting mm-hmm. the destruction of those buildings. She said, now I'm going to have to be one of the picketers protesting the destruction of the Lever House.
Well, that shows you, you live long enough, all kinds of things come around, right? It is extraordinary, though. The real frontier in historic preservation today is modernist preservation. I just earlier today had a meeting with some people from the National Trust for Historic Preservation in Washington to talk about their whole new initiative that they're calling Modernism and the Recent Past, which is focused entirely on preserving modern buildings.
Well, part of the problem when modern buildings were originally erected is that they seemed out of place mm-hmm. often because mm-hmm. in a city like New York, which had much older buildings, they looked weird situated next to something that we had a lot of affection for but then had a Versailles roof.
Right.
How do we deal with that?
Well, I would actually respectfully differ slightly with you on that, and I think sometimes modern buildings look best when they're surrounded by older buildings. I mean, a glass building can be kind of a beautiful jewel amid a street of stone buildings. And in fact, the biggest problem we have with modern architecture is that it's much tougher to make a whole city out of it. A glass building is beautiful when it's the, as I said, the single jewel amid other things. A whole street of glass buildings, as we've seen all too often, is actually
in Dallas or in places
right,
like that.
And unfortunately in New York in certain areas too, is actually not a wonderful thing to walk past or look at or anything else.
But it is the sort of thing that led Prince Charles to mm-hmm. complain about a gorgeous, what seemed to me a gorgeous Mies van der Rohe that was being planned for London.
Yes.
And the building was never built.
Yes. Prince Charles, with all due respect, I think proceeds from a really simplistic view of architecture and does not make a distinction between modern masterpieces, of which there are a number, and the failure of modern architecture to make a good general architectural language that you can make ordinary buildings out of, which modernism has not done so well at.
I mentioned the Lewis Mumford idea about making buildings and neighborhoods where everybody interacts, mm-hmm. but some might argue that we don't need cities anymore to provide substantive, diverse interactions. That all happens online now.
What happens online can be wonderful if the baseline is no contact at all. Then contact online is pretty great. And if you're physically isolated, contact online can be a godsend, a lifesaver. But there's no substitute for real face-to-face, in-person contact the way cities can encourage and create. And they create endless surprise. Serendipity is really, in a way, the greatest gift cities give us.
This is something William White wrote about,
yes.
Where the most successful streets were streets where people could congregate, they could sit, they would bump into each other.
Yes, and William White was the prophet of good city life in many ways in our time, and he taught all of us about the magic of serendipity and the wonder of great public places in a city.
So when a new building is going up, mm-hmm. how do you decide that it's a good building or not?
Well,
what are your criteria?
I try to talk about this a little bit in Building Up and Tearing Down, which is a collection of criticism mainly from The New Yorker. And so I talk a little bit there about being an architecture critic and what it's like. You try to judge it from a number of angles, no pun intended, at once. There is a building as an aesthetic object, of course, has to come into play, but also how it fits into its context, the building as an urban object, the building as a functional thing, how well does it work? And I try to talk to people who use it or will use it and get some sense of it. And then the building as a kind of experience, what it feels like, as well as what it may mean for architectural history.
And some of the buildings you write about in that book, Time Warner Center from Skidmore, mm-hmm. Owings & Merrill, the Renzo Piano New New York Times building, Rem Koolhaas's Prada store in Soho, mm-hmm. Norman Foster's addition to the Hearst headquarters, all prominent architects.
Right.
And that is something that's new. We used to have a couple of famous architects, but for a long time, New York shunned the celebrity architects.
New York did. New York is a very difficult place to build, and I don't know whether the city shunned them or clients shunned them, the people who were going to build. But that's begun to turn around. I think it's one of the benefits of this age of much greater architectural interest on the part of the general public. So we see far more buildings, at least before the economy went south, that is. We were seeing a lot more buildings by a lot of prominent architects in New York.
Well, was it harder to build because we had those zoning rules where all the buildings started looking like ziggurats?
That was some of it, but you know, every place except maybe Houston has zoning rules and restrictions. And I mean, San Francisco is a tougher place to build than New York. Boston is a hard city to build. There's always going to be issues anywhere. But the question is how, you know, a good architect is also capable of a creative response to those things.
Well, when we talk about architecture, we're talking about exterior and interior.
Yes.
I hate to keep on bringing up Mies van der Rohe, but he's one of my heroes.
Mm-hmm.
And the Seagram Building is one of the most beautiful buildings in New York.
Yes.
The exterior, the interior is rather nondescript, except for the Four Seasons Restaurant.
Well, the lobby and the Four Seasons Restaurant are really both truly great interior spaces. The offices, though, are... I thought of them as nondescript until I've looked at some of the glass buildings built since. And you see that there is a certain elegance and purity and fineness of detail and symmetry and everything else to that building that you don't see in every building.
But different architects will work in the same building.
Mm-hmm.
We tend to think of one architect as being responsible for everything, but they often hire somebody else to do the interior.
Sure. Also, in a very large office building, a company may, you know, lease 3 floors and hire an architect to completely do its own space, maybe many years after the building was finished. Sure.
You don't particularly admire the Time Warner Center and the Prada store in Soho.
Right.
What's wrong with them?
Okay. Time Warner, I've sort of, you know, sort of like we were talking about the World Trade Center, I've kind of made a peace with, especially since I live on the West Side, not all that far.
Will it replace the Coliseum, which we didn't love
either. And it replaced the Coliseum, which is probably one of the worst buildings that has ever been built in New York, and something that, thank goodness, that even the most rabid historic preservationist never argued to save. But I found Time Warner kind of large, a little bit glitzy. The idea of an interior mall feels to me very un-New York. And it's not, other than the fact that it's round at the base, reflecting the shape of Columbus Circle, which I really do like, and it got rid of the Coliseum, it struck me as kind of a little glitzy, and the whole model of a huge building that has a mall, offices, condos, and a hotel always felt to me more Chicago than New York. You know, North Michigan Avenue is filled with those things.
But it's working.
And in fact, as I said, I live on the West Side, and I end up there a fair amount and shop there some and eat there some and all that stuff. So I've kind of grudgingly come around to it, yes.
Well, it's addressing the city.
Yes, it does.
In the past, we sometimes didn't do that. Lincoln Center was built with its back turned to the Amsterdam houses, which was public housing next door.
Yes.
They decided to put the entrance on Columbus Avenue in front of 13 lanes of traffic instead of opening it to the neighborhood.
That's exactly right. And in fact, now Lincoln Center is spending hundreds of millions of dollars trying to correct some of those mistakes. And in Building Up and Tearing Down, there's a couple of essays about Lincoln Center from The New Yorker that talk about the whole redo of it. How they've hired Diller, Scofidio, and Renfro, actually very, very gifted architects, to redo Lincoln Center and try to update it without changing some of the key aspects of it that now, in fact, in this age of modern nostalgia, have become almost quaint relics from the 1960s, but make it more livable, weave it into the city fabric better, make it a place that's more inviting than it has been.
Now, you list some buildings that you really love, and one of them is in Kansas City, another one is in Malmo, Sweden, another one is in Munich.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know...
Not New York.
Buildings... You have to go to buildings. Buildings don't come to you. I mean, as an architecture critic, you are doomed to get on airplanes a fair amount. But New York.
What makes those buildings great? By the way, we have photos of them on a slideshow on our website, WNYC.org.
The building in Munich, I think, that I was talking about there was Herzog and de Meuron's Allianz Stadium, a great soccer stadium that is just magnificent. It's done with this whole. Plastic exterior, really. In fact, it looks in some ways like a vast automobile tire, like a vast Michelin tire on its side. But it's quite exciting, actually very, very beautiful when you approach it, and does not look at all silly, as you might think something like that would. And is far more inventive than most stadiums we've ever done in this country.
And why weren't Yankee Stadium? Citi Field almost seems charming and seems to work a little better, but neither of them are great architecture.
Neither Citi Field nor Yankee Stadium is great. They are both, I think, better than what they replaced, because the old stadiums, I mean, Shea Stadium was a real embarrassment. It was a horror. And Citi Field is a much, much nicer place to go to a game in. The new Yankee Stadium, I think, is also a pleasanter place to go in. I found it's a little bit of a slightly pompous stage set version of what you think Yankee Stadium should be, but it's better than what we had, because, of course, the stadium that was left was not the original Yankee Stadium. It was so completely altered in the 70s that there was almost nothing left of the original Yankee Stadium, so the history was kind of gone.
Ram Koolhaas is one of the most influential architects in the world. You don't like his Prada store.
I do not like his Prada store.
What bothers you about it, other than it seems to be impossible to walk through?
Well, that's itself a problem. I found his Prada store sort of pretentious and silly and self-important, as if he'd kind of he presented it as if he'd invented the whole idea of how you can creatively display merchandise in an exciting environment that engages people. And in fact, most of it was filled with gestures that struck me as disingenuous, fake, and not all that original. I compared it to the Toys R Us in Times Square, which I felt was doing pretty much the same thing, but actually doing it much better than Rem Koolhaas did in this much vaunted Prada.
Although you did admire his library in Seattle.
I did indeed. You're absolutely right. His library in Seattle, I think, was much better. It's a much more serious building. And I think CCTV tower in Beijing is also a remarkable building.
Now, listeners, keep on writing in about favorite buildings of theirs, the Woolworth Building, the Cooper Union Building.
Woolworth and Cooper Union could not be more different, those two buildings. The Woolworth is certainly a favorite of mine. I think it's one of the greatest skyscrapers ever built, and it remains, I think, very visually powerful and very fresh. Even now, it dates from 1913. It's almost 100 years old. Cooper Union is the brand new building by Tom Main, which is, I think, one of the best new buildings in New York in a decade.
Paul Goldberger will be giving a talk and signing books tonight at 6:30 at the Tenement Museum. That's at 108 Orchard Street, as well as next Monday, the 23rd, at the Skyscraper Museum at 39 Battery Place, and that's at 6:30. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Leonard. Good to be here.
On tomorrow's show, Elvis Costello talks about his music and the second season of his TV show, Spectacle, on the Sundance Channel. And then I'll speak with director Henry Selick about his critically acclaimed animated films, Coraline, The Nightmare Before Christmas, and James and the Giant Peach. Also, Salvatore Scribona on his National Book Award debut novel, The End. Plus, the gurus of how-to, Al and Larry Ubell, answer your home repair questions. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Julia Corcoran, Blakeney Schick, and Stephen Valentino. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we had help today from Andrea Maraskin, Barbara Kahn, and Adam Delahanty. Debbie Fanta was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening. We will see you tomorrow.